Hey then, welcome to Making Positive Psychology Work, the weekly podcast where we uncover tested practical ways to help people move from functioning to flourishing at work, so together we can better navigate the incredible challenges and opportunities our world faces. I'm your host, Michelle McQuaid, and what you probably don't know about me is that I love savouring beautiful art, and one of my favourite paintings of all time is Picasso's Girl Before a Mirror. Oh yeah. Thank you so much for joining me for lesson number 56 of Making Positive Psychology Work. I'm so glad you're here because today we're talking to Richard Ryan, who's a professor at the Institute for Positive Psychology and Education at the Australian Catholic University and a research professor in psychology at the University of Rochester in New York. Rich is a clinical psychologist and co-developer of self-determination theory, one of the leading theories of human motivation. And with over 300 papers and books in the areas of human motivation, personality, and psychological well-being, he is among the most cited and influential researchers in psychology and social sciences today. He's lectured in more than 80 universities worldwide, consulted with numerous organizations, schools, clinics, and healthcare initiatives, and his newest book, Self-Determination Theory, written with his colleague Ed Desi, brings together more than 40 years of research. But what you probably don't know about Rich is that he enjoys oil painting and tries to grab a brush whenever he can. Welcome, Rich.
Yeah, thanks very much, Michelle, for that kind introduction.
It's wonderful to have you here because I think finding ways to motivate people to do their best work is a question that organisations continue to grapple with. And in your latest book, Self-Determination Theory, you and Ed pull together such an extensive body of research to try and help answer this question. So what have you been finding actually works?
Well, you know, we've really seen a change in all of the thinking about motivation over the last couple of decades. You know, when I came into the field, it used to really be the question, how do we motivate people from the outside? How can we use incentives or threats or various, you know, carrots and sticks to get people to move? And really, you know, I think we've seen the limitations of that approach. And today, really, the question is not so much how can you move people from the outside, but how can we build on the already inherent excitement and interest people have in working and wanting to do a job well, amplify that in the workplace, provide the conditions that support that, and really have the most engaged workers that we can have.
So, Rich, that makes so much sense, but there are still so many leaders that come back to the old carrot and stick kind of approach. Why do you think organizations and leaders struggle to get their heads around what your research has actually found?
Well, you know, first of all, you know, the reception that I get at organizations is mostly very positive because I think, you know, most effective modern leaders really do see that what they want is a really willing, volitional, engaged worker. And so they really do care about the conditions that shape that. I do think there's a lot of old school thinking that remains around that says it's about the carrots and sticks. But when you see managers who are affecting that, usually that's because they've already gotten a contaminated workplace. They've created a self-fulfilling prophecy. So, you know, I think if you've got somebody who manages through carrots and sticks, their employees come to respond only to carrots and sticks, and they say, see,
yeah.
That's how it works here.
And I think one of the areas I see that in particular is around this area of change and how organizations approach change. And we still see a lot of that kind of create some anxiety and get the carrots and sticks out to get people moving. And of course, what we often get is compliance, but not commitment. And the moment leaders move on or we adapt to the carrots and sticks, most of us go back to doing what we were doing before. So when it comes to getting commitment for behaviours, what are the factors that you're finding in the research are so important for leaders to be able to enable in their people?
Well, I think, you know, most people want to feel like they're a part of what's going on in the workplace and contributing. And so, you know, when you want people to get on board with the mission of your team or with your company, in part, you want to have them feel some ownership of that. So you want to explain the goals. You want to talk that through with your employees. You want to have them feel like they are a part of the team. And this is a management style we call autonomy supportive. And this means also that you're providing rationales for why we're doing what we're doing. You're listening to workers when they have inputs, when they find obstacles, instead of just trying to run over obstacles with bigger rewards or bigger sticks. We're trying to find out, well, what are those obstacles? And let's work together to design this in a way that we can really feel mastery and accomplish the job. You know, I think most modern workers really do want to feel effective in their job. They want to feel that sense of mastery. They want to feel investment in the company, and they want to, you know, have a job well done. So management's about uncapping that tremendous energy that employees have and helping them put it to use.
It makes perfect sense. And I know in your research in particular, you and Ed have discovered that those needs for autonomy, for competence and relatedness seem to be fundamental to human flourishing. Why do you think this is the case?
Well, we call autonomy, competence and relatedness basic needs because if you're missing any one of them, then you can really see the absence of vitality and flourishing in a person. I mean, everybody, when they're doing a job, no one doing a job is going to be motivated unless they feel like they can be effective at it. So here's the competence piece is, you know, only if we feel like we can do something are we going to attempt to do it. But more than just, I mean, I guess every theory of motivation has competence as a pretty central component, but also that sense of willingness, the excitement we bring to something when we are volitional in doing it. This is the autonomy piece. And of course, somebody who's lacking autonomy, you can just see the drainage and depletion that comes about from that. And I think, you know, furthermore, in a workplace, we also want to feel connected with the people around us. We want to feel like we matter, that we're a significant part of an organization. And that's the satisfaction of relatedness. You take any one of those things away, you will have a much less engaged, productive, and happy worker. So this is why we call them basic needs. Every single one of them needs attention.
I know the debate around how basic those needs are has kind of raged on a little bit over the last 40 years from different motivation researchers, but also that neuropsychology is helping to improve our understanding perhaps about how basic some of those needs are. What are you learning? What is neuropsychology and the ability to use that kind of technology starting to add to your understanding about what motivates us?
Well, you know, as a psychological theory, our focus has always been on predicting people's behavior and how elements in the environment, how managerial styles, for instance, or how various incentive packages affect behavior has been the test of our theory. But neuropsychology is coming through and also giving us another level of description of what's going on in those events. So, for instance, now we can see when people are intrinsically motivated, even without external rewards, we can see the reward areas of their brain being activated by an interesting task or by an exciting question. So we no longer have to depend on the old idea that rewards are always coming from the outside. We can see those internal rewards percolating inside the person. And similarly, when people are feeling self-directed and when they have that sense of autonomy, we can watch the efficiency of the supervisor areas of their brain and the medial prefrontal cortical areas and how robust those processes are under the right motivational conditions. So neuropsychology allows us to test some more nuanced hypotheses, but also just validate some of the functional knowledge that we've had for a long time in behavioral science.
Which is pretty exciting. So as leaders start to wrap their heads around that, Rich, what are the kind of outcomes they might realistically expect if they are starting to help their employees more consistently meet those needs for autonomy, competence and relatedness as they go about their jobs?
Well, I think most companies are really focused on the KPIs of the company. You know, they want to make profit. They want to have their divisions be efficient in what they're doing. But of course, the best way to that is motivated employees who are really committed and caring about what they're doing on the job. So, you know, what we do as interveners and as motivational consultants is really look at all elements of what's going on in the workplace. We look at managerial styles and help managers become more autonomy supportive rather than controlling. Also look at elements of job design. Are there ways in which jobs can be organized and structured so that it maximizes the intrinsic motivation that workers can have? We look at the incentive systems to see whether are the incentive systems signaling really control and pressure on employees or instead they conveying value and appreciation for a job well done. We even look at what the company means to the employees. Do they have pride in the company? Do they see the company as being invested in something larger than itself and caring about its stakeholders? Or are they really all about the profit, which can be very alienating to employees? So, you know, we look at a whole array of factors in the workplace that are associated with really a truly engaged employee as opposed to, you know, the old school style. We just need to get out a bigger carrot.
There were so many great tips that you just gave us in there, and we're going to be sure to put those into the Making It Work cheat sheet for people, which they can get at michellemcquaid.com/podcast56. But I'd love to just dive into a couple of those a little more deeply. So the first one you mentioned was how do we teach leaders to be more autonomy supportive of their employees? Can you give us an example? What does that look like practically?
Well, you know, if I'm an autonomy supportive manager, then the first thing I'm doing is when I'm trying to motivate my employees to do something, I'm trying to understand it from their perspective. I want to understand what the job or the demands that I'm making means to them. I want to be able to grasp and have them also communicate to me any obstacles or compromises that they see in the way of that. I want to make sure that they feel like they're supported in respects by the team as a whole. So I guess the essence of autonomy support begins with when you take the worker's point of view, you're trying to design the circumstance so that they can really put their energy toward the end task that we've assigned to them. And that means empowering as opposed to putting power over on them. And that empowerment is a nuanced thing, but it's also easy to teach you. But I would say number one starts with listening.
Absolutely. And I know a lot of organizations have increasingly been investing in training their leaders to build more coaching cultures. Do you think having a coaching culture is an important part of being more autonomy supportive?
Well, I'm a clinical psychologist, but I've really been inspired by the rise of the executive coaching industry and the coaching culture idea more generally, because the coaching culture really reflects that our greatest resource within organizations is the energy of our people. So by trying to cultivate and find the nutriments for that energy, we're really vitalizing our organizations. So, no, I really think this is a great new movement within organizational training and HR divisions. STT has been a big, I think, contributor to that by focusing on these needs of the individual.
You also mentioned in that wonderful list the incentive systems, and your work on self-determination theory was so beautifully captured in the book Drive by Daniel Pink, particularly around this topic. And at the time Drive came out, I was working in a large auditing and accounting firm where bonuses had become the bane of management's existence because they had to get bigger and bigger every year. So what is your advice for leaders in terms of how do they get that balance of incentives and monetary rewards without undermining people's sense of intrinsic motivation?
Well, we all at work care about monetary rewards, but a big issue is how they're used and how they're administered in terms of motivation. So I think most people do want to be paid well, but part of that is because the pay means to them that they're valued and the organization cares about them. But you can pay somebody just the same amount, but in a way that actually just feels pressuring and controlling to them. Just to give an example of that, a lot of companies have what we call outcome-focused rewards. So you're going to get a bonus if you achieve certain goals. Mm. And what we've argued in organizations is that can really corrupt the organization, because if you're paid to reach a certain goal, that means you're being reinforced for any route you get there. And there are many bad routes to, say, getting a raised quarterly profit. You can do that by actually being more productive, but you can get there by letting go of workers or by cooking the books or many other ways. The problem with outcome-focused rewards is that they don't always support the best practices within organizations. We find that reward systems that are more loosely coupled with outcomes and that really more recognition of a person's total job tend to be more effective at helping them both feel valued but also not have that contaminating effect. And that's just one little example. I mean, when we go into incentive systems, we find that there are many details and nuances. The important point from SDT is, what are they conveying to the employee? Are they conveying pressure towards certain outcomes? Are they conveying value for the work being done? Do they feel equitable? Do they feel fairly distributed? These questions will have a big impact on motivation.
One of my other favorite books, Rich, that you have helped co-author, is Glued to Games. And I know, in addition to all the amazing research and teaching you do, that you have a role in the company Immersive as co-founder and chief scientist. So where do games, and particularly some of that emerging field of gamification over the last few years, where do you think that might intersect for organizations creating environments that are more supportive of these basic psychological needs we all have?
Well, part of the interest that Scott Rigby and I had when we got into the games business was we could see that video games and other online offerings had such strong motivational pull. People who aren't motivated in any other sphere of life will spend hours and hours playing a video game and doing the work that they need to do to build up their characters within the game. We thought we should understand what these motivational principles are that are so hooking and, as we call in the book, gluing people to games. And what we found is that really the best game designs are ones where people feel a lot of choice, a lot of alternatives and options, which helps empower their autonomy. They allow them to personalize and design things for themselves. They also give people easy routes to mastery, lots of feedback, both dense feedback for what they're doing in the moment, but also goals and larger levels that they're aspiring to. And thirdly, great games help people connect and help each other out and mentor each other and then provide a great deal of relatedness satisfaction. So when we saw that games, well, at least the successful games, had these elements of supporting autonomy, competence, and relatedness, we thought, well, how can we apply that to other kinds of applications, both in employee engagement and health engagement and other areas, to bring about some of those same positive behavioral results? And so that's what we do at Immersive. We take game design and technology designs that really support autonomy, support feelings of competence, support relatedness, and apply them to places where we think they're needed.
So are you finding more organizations are taking an interest in this? I know for myself, playing in the gamification space a few years ago, it was a hot topic. And, you know, we thought every part of work, you know, may eventually be gamified in some way. And I think as organizations started to play with it and people set out with high levels of motivation and collected their badges and points and things like that, we underestimated the role that adaptation might play over time to those kind of things. And any of us who've used an app on our phone, perhaps to improve health behaviours, may have found some of that same kick in where novelty starts to wear off after a while. So are you seeing organisations find more effective ways now to make games sticky and really continue to work to those basic psychological needs we have? Or is this still something that we're really figuring out and haven't quite got the answers to yet?
Well, I'm not a big fan of gamification writ large, because usually what that means is people just take a few elements or features they've seen in games and then throw them into the workplace or throw them your HR program. Really, the reason games work themselves comes back to the motivational principles that are embedded in good game design. And of course, that's got to be true of gamification too. If it's not based in solid motivational principles, throwing an extra badge or two into employees' lunchbox isn't really going to help anything. So, you know, gamification is both good and bad. When we think of the real application of this, it's really, again, coming back to the idea of how can we build in features within our organizations that really empower people and help them feel that sense of autonomy in their work, give them that sense of choice and options that games often provide. How can we give them the kind of proximal and distal feedback and goals that games do such a good job at, so people can feel that they're making progress and feeling mastery on an everyday basis, which is what happens again in games? And how can we help people better connect with each other, not just through gadgets and chat boxes, but actually finding ways that they can help each other out, team up, and feel all the satisfactions that come from that in work?
I know another area of your research looks at how do you guide wellness and health initiatives, or, you know, catalyze high vitality in our workforces as well. And it seems almost every time I open my email at the moment, somebody's sending me a new health or wellness app that I should try out. Is there something in particular that you're seeing or have been part of that you think actually is doing a really effective job of helping improve well-being in workplaces that connects some of those principles of good games?
Oh, absolutely. I think that there are we're increasingly seeing better designed health programs. You know, the early ones started out with the same old tired incentive programs. And what you see with incentive programs is that insofar as incentives can mobilize some health behaviors, they don't last any longer than the incentives themselves do. You either got to keep incentives going continuously, or you've got to keep upping them to make any behavior change. And even then, they're not that effective. Mm-hmm. When people change in health, it's really because they have to have some buy-in. They have to understand what the good is in it for them. And then they also have to have a pathway that's going to be sustainable, because it's in fact interesting and connecting them with other people. In other words, it's providing some of those psychological satisfactions of relatedness and competence feelings. So, you know, for us, designing a wellness program is really, again, coming back to basic psychological needs. It's also making sure it works for people in their particular setting, because each of us is going to get to our health outcomes in different ways.
Absolutely.
So personalization is huge in this sphere, finding a menu of things from which people are going to be able to select some things that work and interest them.
Are there apps or games in particular that you think are doing a good job of that people could try?
Well, there are a lot of apps out there. I'm just going to give you one example that came from our work with Immersive. We were doing some work with Johnson & Johnson, and we helped them with an app that was called the 7-Minute Workout. 7-Minute Workout was just a thing that people could actually do in their hotel rooms while they were traveling. That was the original idea of it. It's, you know, kind of a portable workout that actually would be effective in helping you get in shape, but not so overbearing you couldn't fit into your tight schedule. So, you know, part of our job was just to help tune that up to make it more attractive and accessible to people. And that went pretty viral for a while. So things like that, I think there's a lot of tools we have out there.
I actually use the 7-minute workout myself most days, so I highly recommend it. And I do use it in hotels. I've been known to be jumping on the hotel chair while you do the jumps. So it's been a great tool. So thank you for that. Rich, are there any cautions or caveats you think organizations need to be mindful of as they try to support people's needs for autonomy, competence, and relatedness?
Well, again, I think when we think about the basic needs that employees have, they're pretty broad sweeping. The idea that we're going to have people feel empowerment, to have a sense of choice, to be able to feel like they can make inputs, that's just going to be a big thing in all workplaces, to have feedback where they can see where they're progressing and feel that mastery. That's really important. And then, you know, I think the way we try and build relatedness in organizations is often really hokey. You know, we just kind of throw people into activities that we're hoping they connect, but real connection comes because we provide opportunities for people to help each other, to feel that interconnection and interdependence in work. That really is the thing that builds relatedness within workplaces. So these things, in some sense, are pretty obvious, and in other ways, they're pretty nuanced. And so, you know, when we look at organizations, we say, you know, experiment, try again, listen to your employees, and then try again, because change is what it's all about. It's always a continual transformation towards betterment, and that's what a nimble organization is doing today.
I completely agree. Rich, are you ready for the lightning round?
Well, maybe it's early in the morning, but I'll give it a shot.
So if we take self-determination theory as a given, I'm curious what other well-being insight, tool, or practice has made the biggest difference in your own life and why?
Well, I'm not sure this is outside of self-determination theory, but one thing that has been very valuable to me is the practice of mindfulness. Mm-hmm. And even within self-determination theory, we think mindfulness is often a ground for autonomy. If we can get more aware of what's going on in the moment, both inside and outside, we're going to be in a position to make better choices and better exercise the autonomy that we have. So I would say, you know, the practice and training in mindfulness is something useful to people in virtually every walk of life.
I agree. And if we take your own book on self-determination theory, which I highly recommend as a given, I'm wondering, is there anything else in particular you'd suggest people read when it comes to bringing out the best in people in workplaces?
Well, you know, the book that we just wrote is really a comprehensive book that reviews both the research and practice from self-determination theory. Therefore, it's kind of a technical book, and it's a great treatment for insomnia.
So, I'm still working my way through. It's so rich. It is so packed. I mean, talk about a life's work. It's a complete tribute to you and to Ed and all the researchers that have been part of it. But it is not a light read. I will say that, Rich.
No, it's not a light read. So I think a good thing for self-determination theory has been there's been a lot of popular books that have really been translating it into management language and talk. One of the ones I read recently that I liked was, I think it was Doshi and McGregor. It's called Prime to Perform. They do a nice job of summarizing some things with SDT. Susan Fowler has some really nice books out there on self-determination theory-based practice. Of course, you mentioned Dan Pink before. So I think there's a bevy of popular writers who are taking the principles of self-determination theory and trying to put them in accessible tones.
And Rich, what are you reading right now and are you enjoying it?
Well, I'm a kind of reader who is like somebody who would go up to a buffet and sample a little bit of everything. So I tend to read small bits and pieces of things. But I did just finish one entire book, which is unusual for me. And I think you'll find this amusing. It was The Real Story of the Ned Kelly Gang.
You're brushing up on your Aussie history.
I'm trying to learn that Aussie history and get a sense of how the place has become what it is.
Well, it's certainly, as we would say, a good yarn. So I'm glad you enjoyed it. And lastly, Richard, there's one thing you wished everybody thought about when it comes to bringing out the best in themselves and others in workplaces. What would it be?
Well, I think, you know, mainly when we are encountering anything that's a motivational issue in ourselves or others, we want to take a frame of reference that's compassionate. So I think when I'm a manager and I see a worker struggling with their engagement, I want to come to them and understand from the inside what's in their way, and then see if together we can find a way to remove that obstacle. And I would say I want to apply that same self-compassion and listening style with myself when I'm in moments of motivational lull. So I think it's about compassion, it's about listening, and it's about really having the faith that everybody would really love to do a great job if they get the right conditions for doing it.
I love that advice. Thank you so much for being with us today, Rich.
Michelle, it's been really enjoyable talking with you.
And thank you for listening. For more information on Rich's wonderful work, be sure to grab his new book, Self-Determination, and visit selfdeterminationtheory.org, where you'll find all of his wonderful research papers and some great self-determination resources. And as always, we'll be sure to put these URLs into the show notes for you. You've been listening to Making Positive Psychology Work with Michelle McQuaid. To grab your special Making It Work cheat sheet from today's podcast and some of the tested practical ways you can enable more autonomy, competence, and relatedness in your workplace, simply visit michellemcquaid.com/podcast56. That's michellemcquaid.com/podcast56. And if you'd like to perform a random act of kindness today, then share this podcast with a friend or colleague to help improve our workplaces. After all, as Amy Pelea wisely said, great people do things before they're ready. They do things before they know they can do it. Until next time, take care.